All right, let's dive deep today into what makes us tick, human motivation and emotion. We're exploring chapter 10, which breaks down those forces that make us, well, us.
Yeah.
You know, ever find yourself saying no to that second piece of cake, but then staying up way too late to finish a good book? That's the kind of stuff we're going to unpack.
And it goes way beyond just willpower. What's really interesting is that our motivations, our emotions, they're shaped by this mix of biology, evolution, even our social lives. It's almost like a tapestry woven from our genes, how we were raised, the whole culture we live in.
Okay, so let's start unraveling this tapestry then. Mm. The chapter starts with these basic motives, hunger, thirst, and, well, you know, the drive to keep humanity going. These seem pretty simple, right?
Yeah, on the surface they do. When you think about evolution, these basic drives are about survival, both for us as individuals and, of course, for the species as a whole. But even these basic motives that seem so simple, they're actually more complex than you might think.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
Like, take hunger, for example. We know we need food. Our bodies need fuel. But what about those times you eat when you're not really hungry? Like maybe you're stressed or bored or even celebrating.
Oh, that's a good point. So it's not always our stomach that sends us to the fridge.
Right. And that's where things get really interesting. As humans, we're not only run by these basic survival instincts, you know, the need to eat, drink, all that. We also have these more complex motives, like wanting to achieve something, wanting to belong, wanting to be independent, even wanting to be, well, dominant in some cases.
So not just surviving, but thriving.
Exactly. And these motives, they're not always about physically surviving, but more about how we succeed in a social world.
So it's like we're all trying to find our place, connect with each other, and yeah, make our mark.
And how we try to fulfill those motives well, that can be incredibly different for everyone. It really often depends on our individual personalities, our past experiences, and even cultural background. Like, for instance, in some cultures, achievement might be all about individual success, while in others, it's about what you give back to the group.
So it's nature, A-N-D, nurture, all rolled into one, shaping who we are and what drives us. Okay, I'm hooked. Now let's talk about love. Chapter 10 goes into the different types of love, and this has always fascinated me. What's the real difference between that crazy, can't live without you kind of love and that steady, comfortable love you see after couples have been together, you know, for years and years?
Those are actually perfect examples of the two big types of love psychologists talk about: passionate love and companionate love. Passionate love is that intense, all-consuming feeling, usually full of longing and desire, even a little bit of obsession.
It's like that Romeo and Juliet, can't eat, can't sleep kind of love.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And while it feels so magical and spontaneous, passionate love probably has an evolutionary purpose. I mean, think about it. That intense attraction probably helped our ancestors pair up and, well, reproduce, you know, pass on their genes.
So it's not all about poetry and grand gestures. It's about keeping humanity going. But what about that other kind of love, the one that lasts?
That's companionate love. It's more about warmth, trust, really deep affection, and a feeling of shared history. It's less about fireworks and more about that comfortable feeling of knowing someone inside and out and still, you know, loving them.
That's the old married couple holding hands, finishing each other's sentences kind of love.
Exactly. And this type of love probably developed to keep couples together long enough to, well, raise kids, to ensure their survival, basically. It's really the glue that holds families and whole communities together.
So passionate love brings us together. Companionate love keeps us together. But we all know it's not always simple, right? I mean, relationships can be so complicated.
Absolutely. And that's where something called attachment styles come in. These are like patterns of how we relate to other people, patterns that we develop really early on in life. Often they're based on our relationships with our caregivers, you know, our parents or whoever raised us.
Wait, so what happened to us as kids can actually influence our romantic relationships as adults?
That's right. If you had what's called a secure attachment as a kid, you know, meaning you felt safe, loved, and consistently cared for, well, you're more likely to develop secure attachments as an adult, too. This means you're usually comfortable with intimacy and depending on others in relationships.
And if those early experiences weren't so great?
Well, that's when we see what are called anxious or avoidant attachment styles. People with anxious attachment, they often worry about their partner's love and whether they'll be there for them. They're always craving reassurance. And then avoidant people, they tend to be uncomfortable with intimacy and emotional closeness, and they often pull away when things get, you know, a little too intense.
So our past really can have a huge impact on our present relationships.
Yeah. It's a powerful idea, and it shows how important it is to understand our own attachment patterns and how they might be affecting our relationships.
It's like we're carrying around these invisible blueprints for how to love and be loved.
Exactly. And understanding those blueprints can help us build healthier, more fulfilling relationships.
Yep.
Yeah, it really is fascinating how those early experiences can, you know, shape the way we relate to others. But let's maybe switch gears a little here. Talk about another key idea from Chapter 10, sexuality. It's a topic that often has, well, a lot of misconceptions surrounding it, and definitely one with, you know, lots of societal influence.
Definitely. And it's it feels important to, you know, approach it with some sensitivity, really focus on what the science of the chapter really emphasizes how diverse sexual orientation is, right?
Absolutely. One of the key takeaways is that, well, sexual orientation really exists on a spectrum. It's not just, you know, straight or gay. There's this whole range of attractions, identities, and understanding that complexity is just, it's crucial.
Okay, so where does the science stand now on where sexual orientation comes from? Is it nature? Is it nurture? Or, I mean, is it a bit of both?
That's the question researchers have been trying to figure out for decades. And honestly, we don't have all the answers yet. But the evidence we do have really strongly suggests that biological factors are super important, especially genetics. They seem to play a much more central role than, you know, anything environmental.
So all those theories about, like, how you were parented or what happened in your childhood shaping sexual orientation, those aren't really supported.
No, not really. Those theories haven't, they haven't really held up when scientists have looked at them closely. And it's, you know, really important to emphasize that sexual orientation isn't something you choose. It's a core part of who someone is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's so crucial that we create a society where everyone feels safe and accepted no matter their sexual orientation.
Couldn't agree more. So getting back to the chapter, another really interesting area is achievement motivation. You know, why are some people so driven to succeed, to like climb the corporate ladder, win awards, all that, while others are happy with a, well, more relaxed approach?
Right. Like some people have that fire in them. They always want more, more, more. And others are like totally fine with a simpler life.
And researchers have even figured out ways to measure this drive. You know, one classic method is the thematic apperception test. You might hear it called the TEATED for short. It's what we call a progestive test. They show people these kind of vague, ambiguous pictures and ask them to come up with stories about them.
Ah, so it's like you analyze someone's creative writing to figure out their hidden motivations.
Precisely. The idea is that people's stories, they're going to reveal their underlying needs and motivations, including this need for achievement we're talking about. And people with a high need for achievement, their stories usually involve things like overcoming challenges, striving for excellence, reaching goals.
That's so cool. It's like their internal drives just kind of spills out onto the page. But it's not J.C. He personality, right? The chapter talks about situational things that can influence achievement, too.
Oh, absolutely. Just think about it. You're more likely to, you know, put in the extra effort on a project if you think you have a good chance of succeeding. And of course, if the reward at the end means something to you, makes a difference. On the other hand, if you think you're pretty much guaranteed to fail, or the reward just, isn't worth it, well, you probably won't be as motivated.
So it's a combo, our drive on the inside, PLUS, how we see the risks and rewards in a given situation.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. All right, we've covered love, sexuality, achievement. Now, the big one, happiness. It seems like everybody's chasing it.
Mm.
But what does it actually mean to be happy?
Now, that's a question that's kept philosophers busy for centuries, really. And psychologists are in on it now, too, you know, trying to understand what contributes to happiness and well-being.
And what have they found? Is there a secret recipe for a happy life?
Well, if there is, they're keeping it under wraps. But what we do know is that happiness, it's subjective. It's not about like how much money or stuff you have or even how much you've achieved. It's more about how you experience life, your overall sense of satisfaction, you know?
So it's not what you have, but how you feel about what you have.
Exactly. And research says that, well, our genes and personality traits can actually affect what we call our baseline level of happiness. Some people just might be naturally more inclined to be optimistic and joyful, while others might, you know, lean more towards negativity.
Hold on. So are you saying we're stuck with like a set amount of happiness based on our DNA?
Yeah.
So we can't change how happy we are?
Not necessarily. Our genes might set the stage, but our experiences, our choices, even our outlook, those can make a huge difference in our happiness levels.
So it's not all predetermined. We actually have some say in how happy we are.
Absolutely. And one of the biggest, most consistent findings in all the research on happiness is this. Social connections are powerful. People who have strong relationships, people who feel supported, they tend to report being happier and having a better sense of well-being overall.
So spending quality time with loved ones, that's a good investment if we want to be happier.
One of the best. And it's not just about, you know, having a ton of friends. It's about having those meaningful connections, the kind where you feel seen, understood, really supported.
So quality over quantity when it comes to relationships and happiness.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay, but what about our work? Can our jobs affect our happiness?
For sure. Finding meaning in your work, feeling like you have a purpose, that can be a big source of happiness. When you feel like your work matters, that you're part of something bigger, well, can really boost your overall sense of, satisfaction with life.
Makes sense. But what about those folks who are, like, stuck in jobs they hate?
Yeah, that's a tough spot to be in.
Yeah.
It shows just how important it is to find work that, you know, fits your values, your interests. Even if you can't switch jobs right away, maybe there are ways to find more meaning in your current role, or even to start, you know, exploring other career options.
So it's about taking charge, trying to create a work life that adds to our happiness instead of taking away from it. But what about people who are like just naturally pessimistic? Can they really change their whole outlook and become happier?
That's a great question. And yeah, while it might be harder for some than others, research actually does suggest it's possible to cultivate a more optimistic mindset.
Is it as easy as just like thinking happy thoughts?
Well, it's a bit more involved than that. Cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, can be really effective in helping people identify those negative thought patterns, those things that kind of sabotage their happiness and then challenge them. It's about learning to see things differently, focus on the positive, and find more constructive ways to deal with the tough stuff in life.
So we've been talking about like rewiring our thinking to be happier, but isn't there more to it than just thoughts? What about our physical state? How does that fit into all this happiness stuff?
That's a great point. You know, our emotions, they aren't just things we experience in our minds. They have a really strong physical side too. Chapter 10 actually goes into the physiological stuff that's happening with emotions. It's pretty fascinating.
Okay, so let's get physical then. What's actually going on in our bodies when we feel those big waves of, you know, joy or fear, anger, sadness, all those intense feelings?
Well, it all starts in the brain. The amygdala, for example, it's this tiny little structure shaped like an almond that basically acts as our emotional control center. It's especially involved in processing things like fear and aggression, kind of our brain's built-in alarm system.
So when we see something scary, like, a snake in the garden, the amygdala just like flips out and sets off a whole chain reaction in our body.
Exactly. It sends signals to the hypothalamus, which then activates the sympathetic nervous system, you know, the one responsible for our fight or flight response. That's what gets our heart racing, makes us breathe faster, tenses up our muscles. Basically, it's getting us ready to either face the danger or, well, run away as fast as we can.
Ah, okay. So that's why we get those physical symptoms, you know, sweaty palms, heart pounding. That feeling like you can't breathe, it's our body going into survival mode.
Exactly. And here's the really cool part. Those physical feelings we get, they actually send signals back to the brain, which ends up making the whole emotional experience even stronger. It's like this feedback loop where our body and mind are like teaming up to really amp up the emotion.
Wow. So our emotions are this like powerful mix of mental and physical stuff happening all at once. But I'm curious, is this experience the same for everyone everywhere? Do people in different cultures, you know, experience and express emotions in the same ways?
That's such a fascinating question. And, you know, anthropologists and psychologists have been looking into this for years. It seems like there are some facial expressions for basic emotions that are universal, you know, happiness, sadness, anger, fear. You see those pretty much everywhere. But how those emotions are shown, how people interpret them, that can be really different depending on the culture.
So like a smile doesn't always mean the same thing in different parts of the world.
Exactly. Like in some cultures, it's, you know, it's considered rude to show strong emotions in public. But in others, it's totally fine to like laugh out loud or cry openly. Context is really important.
So we have this this universal biological basis for emotions, but then culture comes in and shapes how we show them and understand them.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this intricate dance between nature and nurture.
Well said. And this kind of leads us to another interesting question. You know, how much control do we really have over our emotions? Are we just like at the mercy of how we feel, or can we actually learn to manage our emotions?
Yeah, that's a question we probably all ask ourselves at some point, right? Especially when we're feeling totally overwhelmed by strong emotions.
For sure. And it's complicated, for sure. On the one hand, we know that certain stimuli or situations can trigger emotions really automatically. It's like our brain's way of quickly figuring out if something's a threat or a reward, you know, and then reacting.
It's like that burst of fear when you almost trip going down the stairs.
Exactly. But here's the good news, we can also learn to regulate our emotions, to choose how we respond to those first impulses. It's not about trying to, like, bottle up our feelings or pretend they aren't there. It's more about figuring out healthy ways to manage them, ways that work for us.
So we're not like puppets controlled by our emotions. We actually have some agency. We get to choose how we respond.
Precisely. And this is where emotional intelligence comes in. It's about understanding your own emotions, being able to read other people's emotions accurately, and then being skillful at handling those emotional responses in a way that's good for you, A&D, for the people around you.
So emotional intelligence, like a muscle we can train. The more we use it, the better we get at navigating that whole complex world of emotions.
Exactly. And research even shows that emotional intelligence, it's a big predictor of how successful people will be in life. Even more so than IQ, actually, which is pretty amazing.
So we can actually work on getting better at handling our emotions and, you know, create a more fulfilling life for ourselves and everyone around us.
You got it. Wow, this has been a great deep dive into motivation and emotion. I feel like I have a whole new understanding of what makes us tick, you know?
I'm glad to hear that. And remember, this is just the start. Chapter 10 gives us a glimpse into this amazing world of human behavior, but there's so much more to learn and explore.
And I guess that journey of self-discovery never really ends, right? We can keep learning, keep growing, keep getting better at understanding and managing our emotions.
Absolutely. So keep asking questions, keep exploring, and keep diving deep into all those mysteries of the human mind. And on that note, fellow deep divers, we've reached the end of our exploration of motivation and emotion. I hope you enjoyed this journey as much as I have. Until next time, keep those brains buzzing and keep exploring.